I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to our 2018 Formula One season review. I'm Joe Dunn, editor of Motorsport magazine, and I'm joined today by a podium of talent. In our office, we have Simon Aaron and Rob Ladbrook. Hello, both.
Good afternoon.
Hello, everyone.
And joining us remotely via the magic of Skype is Mark Hughes, our Grand Prix editor. Hello, Mark.
Hello.
Today, we're going to be looking back on the 2018 season and trying to answer some of the key questions about what happened and why. We'll be helped by dozens of questions from our readers who have sent them in via our website. But I think I'd like to start by asking everyone to cast their minds back to March in Melbourne and the start of the season. It seemed to promise so much. I know we know how it ended, but can you remember those early few races when there seemed to be so much excitement and anticipation about the season ahead? And really, what do we think? Did the season deliver on that, Simon?
I think we have to bear in mind that Melbourne was... It started promisingly from a championship perspective because a Ferrari won, and we kind of got used to Mercedes dominating all and sundry. But that was brought about because of Mercedes' team of 5,000 strategists plugged a wrong number in somewhere and opened the door for Ferrari. But even so, I mean, during the first part of the season, I felt very much that it was a proper two-way fight, two top teams, two fantastic cars, two brilliant drivers, and then it kind of fizzled away from sort of August onwards.
Yeah, it became a bit more of the same. But Mark, you were talking earlier about the reasons for that. What was your kind of overall? How would you sort of sum up the season, if you like?
If you divide, it's 21 races, if you divide the season into three parts of seven races each, at the two-thirds point, which is, Monza, by my reckoning, the Ferrari had been the faster car 10 times from 14 races. There were some errors that meant that didn't translate. But that car was comfortably fast enough to have contended or even won the title. It just wasn't being operated very well from a team perspective. And from a driver perspective, Vettel just made too many errors. And it really is as simple as that. Because in terms of performance, even though Mercedes dominated the last third of the season, in terms of performance over the season, and that's like we tend to have a present sort of skewed picture of competitiveness because, you know, the last seven races we saw, the Mercedes was, in general, the dominant car, so we tend to remember that more than the earlier part of the season when it wasn't. But it was easily a competitive enough car to have won the title, and certainly contended for it. And it was all the more disappointing, therefore, that the Ferrari campaign just collapsed. It really did, even more so than in 2017 when it did quite a parallel story in a way, but amplified.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll come to Ferrari's implosion a bit later on. And there's so much to say about it. Mark, I mean, you travelled the world really reporting on all of these races for our magazine and for the website. What was your sort of standout feature of the season? I mean, was there a single moment or sort of feeling that you sort of think will come to define the 2018 season?
I think the defining moment is probably the thing that everybody's probably going to look back and remember it for is just that moment at Hockenheim when Seb's nosed the car into the barrier and is banging the steering wheel in frustration, having just crashed out of the lead of the race. And in many ways, that was the fulcrum of the whole season. You know, it's really when it just switched. There's a massive point swing, but it's also a huge psychological blow as well. And I don't think it's one they really ever fully recovered from. And I think that's probably the defining moment. If you have to think of a single image that sort of tells the story of the season, it would be that for me.
Rob, you're sort of shaking your head and smiling at that. What do you? I mean, in sympathy, I think, with Seb. I don't know. I mean, do you remember that Hockenheim, you know, disaster really for Ferrari?
Pretty much. I reckon I agree with Mark that was probably the moment that the title was lost. I think that just created that division that was almost soul destroying to the mentality of Ferrari being able to take this fight to Lewis when their talismanic German had gone off in such a, not a bizarre, but such a strange kind of way. It was very un-Vettel. It's not something we've seen from Sebastian very often.
Except in 2018.
Except in 2018, yes. Thank you, Simon.
But I think it was also a multifaceted moment because, A, Vettel leading his home race in a Ferrari and under no real pressure other than the challenge of the weather slid off. B, that opened the door for Lewis, who'd started, was it 13th, 14th? But he started back in midfield after problems in qualifying. And it was a fantastic drive by him. So Mercedes got a huge shot of impetus from that. And at the same time, of course, Ferrari had quite the opposite.
It's quite telling as well that whole conspired from a weekend that initially looked terrible for Mercedes and terrible for Lewis after the problems in qualifying, starting down the grid on the alternate tyre strategy. And of course, when it started to rain, he was on the softer, grippier tyres. And suddenly everything conspired, and what should have been a Ferrari cakewalk ultimately just swung the silver arrow's way again.
Yeah, the weather played a good part in that. There's a sort of three-race sequence. It rescued that race for Hamilton from mid-grid, as you say. It rained in qualifying in Hungary, where in the dry, the Ferrari was easily going to get pole, and all of a sudden it mixed everything up and gave Hamilton another opportunity, which he took to set pole. And again in Spa, he set pole on that occasion and didn't win him the race. He had a little bit of a following wind with luck, or some higher power, because he was standing there as though he'd ordered the rain on the podium in Hockenheim. So maybe there was some of that, an element of that. But it, other than that, they won the title through being better, being a better team, and Hamilton performing to a higher level, and those two things are interrelated, and I don't think you can underestimate that, because when you're at the peak of performance and looking to get into that state of mind that all the top competitors need to get into to do their best stuff, you're gonna have much easier access to that if everything around you is working as it should be, compared to the guy that's worrying, what are they going to do wrong next? What's going to happen here? Am I being shafted here? What's going on here? Why have they not got that right? Why are they putting Kimi out in the wrong place? Why are they putting me out behind a Mercedes that needs a different tire? If you're thinking of all those things, your head is just not going to be in as good a place. And I think that shouldn't be underestimated. And that's where the team performance and the driver performance are very hard to decouple.
I also thought it extraordinary that on a day when they most needed Kimi Raikkonen's cooperation, Ferrari informed him on race morning at Monza that, oh, by the way, he won't be racing for us next year. I don't think Mercedes would have done that, would they?
No, that's
they
didn't
wait until Monday.
No, they just absolutely wouldn't. What on earth are they getting the number two driver to be the beneficiary of the tow at Monza for, rather than the guy who's chasing the title? And B, once you've got yourself in that awkward mess, why do you tell the driver who you need to help you, then put him into a situation where he was more or less forced to drive for himself rather than the team? So, yeah, just poor leadership, poor management, brilliant technically, probably the best team technically out there at the moment, and that's saying something when you've got competitors like Red Bull and Mercedes, but operationally just awful this year.
I suppose you mentioned, we've mentioned Lewis. Now it's an opportune moment to ask the obvious question about how good he is. I mean, Mark, I thought your interview with Toto Wolff was quite illuminating, where he said that his relationship with Lewis had had sort of strengthened and deepened as time had gone on, and how you know, they'd had their problems in the early days, but now it was stronger than ever. And I suppose you could say, well, he would say that, wouldn't he? But it seems to be borne out by the facts. I mean, do you think A, how good is Lewis, and B, how good is he with Toto and with Mercedes? How strong is that partnership?
Yeah, I mean, he's, in terms of his raw speed, he hasn't found more raw speed. That's always been extraordinarily high, you know, since he first came in 11 years ago. But he joins those peaks up much more consistently now. And this season's been his best, I think, because he's achieved a more consistently high level. It's probably you could only point to a couple of races where the weekend sort of got away from him. And that's probably a trait where, if you look through his career, he's always had those weekends where he's not quite nailed the set of the car. He's gone off in the wrong direction a little bit and then not got it back quite enough in time for qualifying or the race. He did that maybe in China this year, maybe in Canada. That was it, really. And so that's where he's become stronger. He's lined those things up. He's working his team more deeply. He's got a little core of people, engineering people around him that he's pumping for more insight, more information all the time. And this is just sort of going into a sort of virtuous circle and adding to his own performance. And that environment where he feels supported and not undermined and no longer paranoid, pretty much devoid of the paranoia that's always part of any top driver in a pressure situation, but it's largely been dispersed over the years as he's come to trust everyone around him. And I think also the replacement of Nico Rosberg with Valtteri Bottas has played a big part in that environment. I don't think there's very much difference, if any, in basic speed of Rosberg and Bottas, but Rosberg was much more combative with Hamilton and would deliberately use psychological warfare as part of his armory. And Valtteri is just not wired up in that way, and it's made for a much more serene environment. So it's hasn't really helped Valtteri's career at Mercedes, but it's enabled Hamilton to get to a more consistently high level than he was achieving when Rosberg was there. And I think it's partly the team, partly Lewis maturing, partly that relationship maturing, and partly a less combustible environment.
Yeah, but I thought he looked more complete in 2018 than at any time in his, maybe even in his racing career. I mean, I watched him in his junior, in the junior categories too. I mean, as you say, the raw speed has always been there. But I mean, he's always had peaks and troughs in his previous Formula One seasons. Not so many troughs, but they've always been there. And I just thought he'd look, in 2018, he looked dynamite from start to finish, pretty much.
He did look incredibly composed for the vast majority of the season. I mean, before, especially when we had the Rosberg thing, a lot of people, while Lewis is a very mentally strong driver, he would tend to either overcompensate or get frustrated on the radio. And we kind of saw or heard hardly anything of that this year. We had a very, so even when things went wrong in qualifying, there was no blaming, there was no social media kind of outbursts. It was very just controlled. It was like, okay, lads, let's get on with this and hold this back. And he did it time and time again. It was just a very controlled performance from start to finish. Made it look so easy and natural.
It's funny that you say that the paranoia had gone, Mark. I mean, he did seem to my eyes, he's almost detached himself from the circus that's going around it. And it's almost like he's this very still calm in the middle of the storm, if you want to put it like that. He doesn't seem affected by anything that's been going on, whether that's in the media or in the paddock. I just wondered, how do you find him in the paddock and on race weekends when you kind of, your paths cross and you come across him in press conferences and such like?
He's, you're right, he's acquired a new serenity this year. He's obviously the number one focus of attention in that paddock, in a paddock that's full of high-profile people. So his usual manner is headphones on, head down, avoid eye contact, just, you know, keep walking to where you've got to be. But in the downtime after all the commitments are finished and you're just there with them, if you're doing an interview with them and you have an understanding, he's very, very chilled, very articulate, very thoughtful, not at all like the image might suggest, the showman side of his persona might suggest.
It's fascinating and a fascinating character and you know, five world championships. I mean, a great driver. Let's dive into some reader questions, because we've had dozens of them. They've all been submitted via our website, and I think probably the easiest way of doing it is almost kind of splitting them off under sort of team headings. So if we start with Ferrari, and I'll start with a question from Pratik Palsal. I'm going to fall victim of a Simpsons spoof name here, aren't I? I can tell. And he says, can you enlighten us to exactly what happened at Ferrari post Marchionne? We've had a couple of questions talking about Sergio Marchionne and his untimely death and how that affected the team. And Mark, I know you were very close to the story. Maybe start off with that question, and really what happened and how much of a shock was it when it happened?
Well, it was a total shock. Subsequent, we find out he'd been ill for a couple of years, but had kept it from even these closest colleagues. So it was a shock. There's no question of that. But he had the expectation of living several years, you know, further to come, and he was seemed to have planned for that to be the case. Ferrari, as I touched on earlier on, I thought was operationally very weak but technically very strong, and I think he'd identified that same thing. And his plan was to, so we are led to understand, was to relieve Maurizio Arrivabene of the team principal role and promote Mattia Binotto. That was the plan for 2019, but then, of course, Marchionne died. So without that having gone through, so that left those two particular people in a very awkward position, and it's one that they're still in. And I think until that is clarified, I find it difficult to envisage how the team is going to move forward and progress. On a day-to-day basis, it wouldn't have changed a great deal. The team was already operationally shaky, and it continued to be. Glaring errors like those that were made at Monza probably wouldn't have happened, but it still wasn't an operationally great team. So I don't think much changed on a day-to-day level, but it's left the team in a sort of state of limbo as to what it does next.
And do you think obviously it would shake any team, but do you think an event like that had affected Ferrari more acutely than other teams, given its makeup?
Perhaps. Stefano Domenicali, the old team manager there, was a terrific guy, and he always used to say that it was his impression that the team felt blows more acutely than say more Anglo-Saxon teams. It's possible, but I think also when you get when you get it going in the upwards direction, it rises up so fast. And I think we've seen that as well. You know, the transformation from 16 to 17 was amazing to behold. So I think, yes, it works both ways. It's like a sort of an engine with not much flywheel effect compared to a one with a heavy flywheel.
It's a slightly mischievous question here from Gav, 1989, who asks, when Daniel Ricciardo beat Vettel in 2014, he was able to run to Ferrari. If Charles Leclerc beats Sebastian Vettel next year and there are no realistic seats available at Mercedes or Red Bull, what is Vettel going to do? Which team is he going to run to for 2020? There seems to be quite a few assumptions there, but I suppose the underlying
well, if you go with all of Gav's assumptions, which I'm not sure I would, but if you went, I think if that turned out to be the situation, I don't think he would go and drive for anyone other than the top three teams. So yeah, he would just go and do something else with his life, would be my guess. I don't think it's a given that he will have a weak season next year. I think he's got a lot on his plate, a lot to sort out, but it's not a given. He's an extraordinary driver, he's an extraordinary competitor. And if he has a strong season and has the appetite for it again, then yeah, what happens at Red Bull in the future, for example? Could we see him back at Red Bull? It's not impossible.
Mm-hmm. There's a secondary point I think as well. Is there any truth to the rumor that Sebastian vetoed Ricciardo, as some people had speculated? Had you got any inside knowledge on that one?
Not as I understand it this time around. The contract that he entered into start of last year was not as loaded in his favour, I believe, as the previous one. So although the previous one may have given him veto, I don't think this one did, no.
Simon, maybe if I could just bring you in. I know we talked about the German Grand Prix here, but another reader has written in, Stephen Pratter. Was the season lost as a result of that accident?
Well, I think we've touched upon that previously, but it was a psychological turning point. I mean, clearly, mathematically, it wasn't lost. Seb was still leading after Hockenheim, wasn't he? But there was a huge mathematical shift. And
it's a 32-point swing.
Yes, a big point swing, as Mark says. And I think it was psychological more than anything else. And I think we saw the effects of that. Not in every race that followed, because obviously he won in Belgium, but in several of the races that followed, you know, driving errors by Seb or tactical errors by the team, it was almost like they were all trying too hard to atone for some of the things they'd just done, and it just snowballed.
Yeah. And I think that's really crucial, isn't it, at that point, that actually if you make mistakes, then it's trying to make up for that mistake that causes future mistakes, if that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely.
And you kind of try and overcompensate, don't you, which seemed to be something that afflicted Ferrari after Germany.
I've got a question, actually. I just wonder if all of the people who thought Lewis was stupid to leave McLaren at the end of 2012 still think the same thing. What do you reckon?
We should have a poll on our website. Mark, what do you think he thinks?
It's easy to be right in hindsight, isn't it? Yeah. Was it a brilliant decision or was it a lucky decision? That would probably be a better question.
It would, yes.
We lost Daniel Ricciardo in 4 years.
I don't see Daniel's move as the equivalent of that one.
Well, speaking of Hamilton and moving on to Mercedes, Valentin Radukan has asked us, is Hamilton, is he now in the top 10 all-time greatest Formula One drivers? Now, from 46 to 2018, this is a question obviously that people can argue about at their leisure down the pub tonight. But, I mean, for the record, where do we put him? Rob, where do you sort of put Lewis now?
This one's not a loaded question at all, is it? we always hear about this. End of the day, I believe it's impossible to gauge a Formula One driver from the 50s and 60s against someone in the... It's a different sport now. It's a different formula now. Yeah. Statistically, absolutely, Lewis is up there. He did things that were almost superhuman around this season. I mean, his qualifying lap at Singapore just being kind of one of the ones. I mean, if you'd stuck a shaky camera on that, it could have been Senna at Monaco, just in the evening. But I'd definitely put him up there. But once again, it's a loaded comparison.
I mean, I wouldn't put a number on it. He is one of the all-time greats. That's beyond question. If I was starting my own Grand Prix team tomorrow and I could pick any two drivers from 1894 to the present day, Tazio Nuvolari would be the first pick. And the second, I'd have to have a long, hard thing. But Lewis would be on the list of possibles.
Mm. Yeah. That'd be quite formidable, wouldn't it? Nuvolari and Lewis Hamilton. Yeah. Mark, I'm afraid I'm going to have to put the same question to you.
Well, Simon's answer is ridiculous. His lead driver would be like 110 years old.
Yeah, well, that's the downside. I still think he'd be quick, mind.
Yeah, probably. Well, I would say he's probably in the top 10 if you're going Formula One. Definitely, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's you'd struggle to find, you know, 9, 10 names to push him out of that top 10, wouldn't you? So yes, I'd say he's definitely in the top 10 as to what position. Well, you can just argue about that in your own heads, really.
I think I really just probably will. Patrick Down asks whether we think that Hamilton would have won the title if he had been at Ferrari this year.
Yes.
Even given Ferrari, as we've just spoken about, Ferrari's internal problems, you think Hamilton would have been strong enough?
I don't think he would have performed as impressively as he did, but I don't think he would have given 100 points away in the way that Vettel did.
Mm-hmm. I think I agree with that. 100%. The difference this year, I think, has been because Mercedes has made some errors as well. Granted, Ferrari's made some bigger ones, but the different factor this year was Lewis's human performance. He was just stellar.
Yeah, yeah.
Did Lewis get involved in any first lap skirmishes this year? I'm struggling to think of any. Whereas Seb seemed to do it every other weekend in the second half of the year.
No, I don't think he did.
I can't think of one. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, I think you probably hit the nail on the head, actually, Rob. I mean, I think that perhaps you could argue that the internal problems wouldn't have been so pronounced had Lewis been the lead driver. In other words, had he sort of cast his calmness and his leadership and his strength of character and had that infused the rest of the team around him, then those problems wouldn't have surfaced in the first place. Leaving aside his driving ability. Let's move on to some more questions. We're go down to Red Bull now, Valentin Raducan. Ferrari has a small advantage over Mercedes in terms of ultimate power output, but how far behind was Honda in its latest spec? Mark, maybe I could throw that one to you.
Yeah, they were reckoned on peak power. It's very misleading peak power with these hybrid engines because it's more to do with how long they're at the best part and what the torque curve and how well they deploy the electrical energy and for how long and stuff like that. But on just as a sort of rule of thumb measure, Honda were believed to be about 50 horsepower down on Ferrari by at the end of the year, which was they'd closed up from the beginning of the year, and were believed to have edged ahead of Renault by the end of the year.
Mm-hmm. Tony Chan here, a question from Tony Chan. One question on the young driver development programs. In 2014, Max Verstappen was approached by both Red Bull as well as Mercedes. Do you believe Max would have been closer to the world championship than he is now had he chosen Mercedes? Again, Mark, what do you think? It's speculative, I know, but what do you think?
Well, he would have had to have been slugging it out with Lewis. Yeah. So
I suppose a more pertinent question would be whether Lewis would have won if Max had been.
I guess there would have. It would have been a fascinating contest to see. But I think it's. I'd prefer to see them in different teams. I'd prefer to see them going at it from different teams, and it would be fantastic if Honda made enough progress that Red Bull could fight for wins next year on merit, and then we would see some classic Hamilton Verstappen dices, I'm sure.
Yes. And again, there was a question here from Samir talking about the disparity between the two Red Bulls towards the end of the season, and asking whether that was down to luck or whether that late season reliability was down to something else.
Oh, I don't think you can read anything suspicious in it. It's just luck. I think it's just waves of luck. I mean, there was a period, I think, last year where Verstappen couldn't get the thing to finish. No matter what he did, it just turns. Just when you have a car that's fundamentally unreliable, which it was, these things can just sort of bite you at random, and it's not that unusual for the randomness to fall one way. For it's just like tossing a coin. If you throw five heads in a row, it's not extraordinary, is it? It's just it'll balance out, and I think that's all you were saying. I don't think there's anything suspicious about it particularly.
I always struggle to comprehend these conspiracy theories when a driver starts to have a little bit of a bad run, and people say, oh, well, Max's car's running fine and Daniel's isn't. I mean, what sense would it make for a team to sabotage its own driver in a time when championship points are worth so much and there's millions of pounds on the table? And not only that, there's 300 or 400 staff that are working flat out back at the thing to see a car stop due to nefarious means. I mean, I can never buy in too much to them.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, I think no one ever said that conspiracy theories had a reason. I think by
they are fun, though.
They are fun. moving on. Oh, there's a fascinating question here from Jacob, who asks about Haas and essentially asking how good they are for bang for buck. Mark, we did a story about Haas, and what do you think? Are they how well have they performed? Will they be happy with their performance this year?
I think they're going to be happy because they've made great progress, and they were. If we look at the field, which it's sad that we have to do it, but if we look at the field in terms of Class A, which is the top three teams, and in Class B, they've probably had, on balance, the fastest car in Class B, although they didn't quite win that mini championship. They were in contention for it. Mm-hmm. They've done well. They've not probably converted the speed of their car to points as effectively as say, Renault have done. But they're a much smaller team, so it's a completely different model to every other team. It benefits from the resource of a much bigger team, Ferrari, and it's that you can see why that model is getting other independent teams so stirred up, because it's outperforming many of them, and you can see how it's doing. You can understand how it would do that, given the resources that go into that car. That have been created. Those resources have been put in place for something else entirely. But they're still unleashed upon that car, and that's you know, it's been a brilliant car, and it's been well run, and it's yeah, I think it only won three times the class between Magnussen and Grosjean. I think they only won three times, which is probably just a reflection of the size of the team, and they got themselves into a few difficulties with things that were a function of not having enough people. But yeah, they're a very interesting addition to the grid, but you can absolutely see why the likes of Williams and McLaren are you know, getting quite aerated about it. And does the model need to be changed?
I do wonder if that sets a good precedent or a dangerous precedent for the kind of future. Because if you can go off and essentially buy a B-spec Ferrari, or in this case an H-spec Ferrari, if you like, and come straight in, be one of the youngest team on the grid, and be fighting with the big names that are still struggling to do it themselves. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Surely it's a good thing on one way that it's shown you can come into Formula One and be competitive if you've got the right people around you. But surely it doesn't do a huge amount to the kind of, you know, the heritage of the Garagistas days that we all like to romanticise about.
But back in those days, the heritage days of the Garagistas, anyone could go and buy a March, a Cosworth engine, a Hewland FG200 gearbox, and, you know, with a few quid, relatively speaking, run a Formula One operation. And you saw, I know Hesketh built their own car, but people like that coming in. And at the time, I know you're too young to have been there, Mark and I aren't, but it did add, certainly to me, that those days when it was more accessible and people could do things. And I understand the mentality of the likes of Williams and McLaren in the current era, but I really liked it when a team could buy a second-hand kit and run a Brabham or a Tyrrell or something and do a decent job.
Yeah, but when you were running, you know, a budget of a couple of hundred thousand rather than a couple of hundred million. Yeah. And so the gap between an entity like Ferrari and a privateer wasn't anything like as big as it is now. It was a nice period of time, but I think something does need to be tweaked a little bit in what constitutes a constructor.
Speaking of Williams, we've got a punchy question from Anthony Jenkins here asking, can the dire state of Team Williams be attributed to Claire Williams' leadership? If not, where does the buck stop? I think that's slightly unfair, but Mark, maybe you could. What's happening with Williams? I mean, where do they go from here?
It's in a bit of turmoil at the moment, but I don't think it would take anything radical to return it to respectability. And Claire, given that she inherited that role when she was very inexperienced, I'm sure that's played a part in that. She's had a strong commercial guide in hand from Michael Driscoll, but technically it needs to be much stronger. And this technical management team that's there now is already probably in the last chance saloon. And I think probably Claire understands all this, but it's a steep learning curve.
You mentioned Class A and Class B before. Were Williams and McLaren in Class C?
you have to reclassify it. I don't know, the Premiership. If Mercedes and Ferrari are Premiership, I don't know what division that puts Williams in. Are they like with Scunthorpe, or I don't know.
One thing with Williams, I mean, there's the point has been made that they're too big to take the advantages of teams like Haas that you're talking about, but too small to be able to compete with obviously the Premier League teams. They're caught in a bit of a no man's land, aren't they?
They are, and this is a big challenge for the framing of the 2021 regulations that Liberty and the FIA have to address, whether you can make it more even, where you can make it realistic for an independent team to be able to get somewhere close or occasionally challenge these teams for race wins and podiums. It's not at the moment. Williams is caught between two stools, but it's all the teams are to all the independent teams are to a greater or lesser extent. It's how much do you surrender and become a client team to a major manufacturer, and how much do you fight to retain your core independence? And Williams is on the independent, very much on the core independent side. At the moment, and Haas is the other extreme, and somewhere in between is probably Force India, or whatever it's going to be called now.
That was a story, wasn't it? What a rescue as well.
Complicated though, and it's still not. The story's probably still not finished yet in terms of the repercussions, and you know who gets what money, and it's ongoing, that one. Fantastic. It was basically too good a team to go down. It's finished fourth on the constructors 2 years and the previous 2 years running. It always delivers a very, very impressive performance for a team of quarter of the size of the biggest ones. It was too good to be let go. It had too much previous success. So it was fantastic that it was rescued, but it's got a bit messy and it's not untangled yet.
And do you think it was the right decision to allow the newly named team to continue with the same with the points and the its previous incarnation had accrued?
I don't think there's a right and wrong. I think it just got so tangled up in Formula One's own intricate rules and regulations, and there's always a situation that somebody's never thought of where a solution is made more difficult than it ought to be. I don't think it's particularly a right and wrong, but you can absolutely understand Haas saying, well, hang on, if this is a new team, how come it gets money straight away and we have to wait until we've completed 3 years? It's a valid question. It's just a function of the reams and reams of regulations that Formula One's ended up having.
Formula One but getting tangled up in its own rules and regulations.
Yes, I know it's quite a shocking theory, isn't it?
It's a shocking thing.
Just let it sink in.
Right. Deep breath. McLaren. What went wrong? Who's to blame? Where can it go from there? There's a lot of big McLaren fans, certainly in our office. What's your take on it, Mark?
It was a combination of errors, not recognising problems and hiding behind the assumption that the shortfall in the past had been down to the engine. What was happening was the whole game was moving on, particularly in the aerodynamic simulation. And although the team may have been operating at a similar standard to what it had been when it was successful, the rest of the field was moving on, certainly at the at the front. But specifically, it was a tale of clashing personalities on the technical side, which I think wasn't recognized quickly enough, and I think probably arose as a consequence of the lack of consistent leadership over the years, because Ron Dennis got involved in boardroom fights and lost his focus on the stuff that makes the team be able to produce a fast car. And then a change of ownership and more boardroom shuffling. And so it's been a very disruptive place over the years. And I think this is, it finally came home to roost with this car. So they get engine parity with Red Bull and they went into that season, thinking, great, we can show that we're as good as Red Bull. And of course, they were nowhere near Red Bull. They began the season a second off Red Bull and ended up probably 2 seconds off Red Bull. And as they retained the same level of performance. Everybody else went forward and they just sunk down to the back. Aerodynamically, it was flawed. They tried to enhance some of the things of the previous year's car, which actually wasn't a bad car. It wasn't great, but it wasn't flawed in the way this one was. And they've basically, it took them half a season to work it out, but it just could not retain the downforce through a long corner. It would give the car very unstable rear, and so the only way you could calm the car down and make it drivable, if you looked on board, it was very drivable, and you'd be forgiven for thinking, well, what's the problem, why is it so slow? And but that came as a function of a big rear wing that they had to put on, a much bigger rear wing than they would have ever had to have simulated to give it the rear stability, because the rest of the car wasn't working aerodynamically. And of course that made it extremely aero inefficient. It was just dog slow down the straights to give it any sort of drivability at all. And that was probably good enough to be upper end of Q2, lower end of Q3 at the beginning of the season, but it barely got you out of Q1 at the end of the season.
Given all of what you've just said, I think that some of Fernando Alonso's performances were beyond extraordinary.
Yeah, absolutely. He kept them in play. The early part of the season, when it was a mid-grid car, he was fifth and seventh places, just automatically just racking up those points. And then as the car fell down the order, you could still grab some places just out of thin air sometimes. You could just, magically conjure something. Just that relentless performance that we've seen all through his career. He never surrenders and always fights.
Where do you think, if I could just turn the attention to, I might come back to Alonso actually, but to Zach Brown, under pressure, do you think, as the chief executive of McLaren? I should say that he's also chairman of one of Motorsport magazine's rivals, Autosport magazine. But do you think he's under pressure internally, Mark?
Under big pressure at Autosport, I don't think.
I hope so.
No, I think he's probably got a year or two of grace left. I think the switch from Honda to Renault proved to be not a great one. Cost money for arguably performance neutral, and left them as a non-works team. That probably, in hindsight, that wasn't a great call, but it was unfortunate that was happening at the same time as the personnel problems in the technical department that I talked about earlier in terms of the aerodynamics. I think it's reasonable that it's taken him this long to get his to get a grasp around it, and I think he's probably got a year or two of grace. But yeah, ultimately, everyone's under pressure to perform, and McLaren isn't a team that it's acceptable to be at its current level.
Just going back to Alonso briefly, Rob, what do you think about Formula One failing to hold on to him? I mean, we're not blessed with too many star drivers. Alonso was certainly one. Do you think they should or could have tried harder to hang on to him?
I think F1's got much larger problems, and whether it just wants to hang on to one of its star drivers or not, in truth. The issue with Alonso is a very combative driver, and I always understood that was the reason that Red Bull pretty much wouldn't want him. He's had his time at Ferrari, so I mean, where was he honestly going to go? This year, actually, as a long time McLaren fan personally, I actually got more and more angry with McLaren as the season went on, because the progress stopped because they had to make compromises. But for year after year, we've had a lot of bluster about things are going to get better, we're going to win with Honda. I mean, Ron Dennis's era was always about promising wins and usually, admittedly and fairly, delivering them. Zach obviously changed focus now to say, look, we're on a recovery and this is going to take time. Well, yeah, how much time is it going to take? And the first thing that you said was, well, we're going to switch to Renault because, well, that's the safe option. Well, in this occasion, the safe option hasn't worked out well. And the unsafe option, if you like, in their minds, Honda, is now going to be with Red Bull. And if Red Bull managed to pull it out, then that will be great. But I don't know, really, is the answer what they could have done with Alonso. Because if you were Fernando Alonso, a truly world-class, brilliant driver, would you honestly want to be exiting Q3 or Q2 every weekend? It's just demoralising, isn't it? So, I mean, you can go to the World Endurance Championship and essentially win as one of only two cars that can win, which is the stark opposite. But it's rocking a hard place, in my view.
I have half a feeling that if MotoGP promoter Dorna was in charge of Formula One, that moves would have been made to keep, you see the way that Rossi goes on for years and years and years, and he's still quick. But Dorna seems to have a way of keeping the big names in the paddock somewhere. I know Formula One doesn't operate in the same way, but I'd love to know, in a parallel universe with Dorna in charge of F1, whether Alonso would have stayed.
Depends. Well, I'm not. I will probably be vilified for this, but two wheels, you'd need to strap two of them together for me to take too much notice. So I'm not in the loop with MotoGP. But presumably the competitive order there is a hell of a lot closer than it is in Grand Prix racing, where we've currently got, I don't know, 4.5 cars that could potentially win a race out of a field of 20. And that field of 20 seems to always shrink as the years go by. So
if we can, we can just finish up on the McLaren topic with a question from Chinthaka Priyasad.
I hope I pronounced that right.
His real name's Kevin Smith.
They've just done this to test me. Simple question. What are your thoughts on McLaren's chances for next season? I mean, I think we've touched on it, but Mark, what do you think? I mean, are we going to see a resurgent McLaren, or is the best we can hope for that they stabilise and kind of hold position?
I think they will return to respectability. I think as a basic building foundation, if you like, for the future. I think the more obvious flaws that there were inherent in this car and what caused them, and what processes caused them to find themselves in this cul-de-sac that they couldn't get out of it in terms of the car, have been understood. And yeah, when you listen to the engineers there explain it, it sort of makes sense. It's got a logic to it, and you quite believe that that's fixable. But it still leaves them as a non factory team, and relying on an engine supplier that in 5 years of the hybrid formula is consistently lagged a long way behind the best. So to imagine that they might be up there contending for race wins, I think is unrealistic. But there's no reason why they shouldn't be mid-grid, upper mid-grid, and respectable and scoring points.
That raises another point, though, doesn't it? Of what exactly, where is the level of acceptability when you're McLaren? You know, we're not talking
higher than that. Because
exactly. I mean, a lot. Yeah. I mean, I would say McLaren outside of the top eight is not particularly respectable, because I grew up with them winning world championships and winning races and being essentially where Mercedes is. So you get that different benchmark, don't you, of respectability? So purely that just amplifies the pressure.
Yeah. But at least it would be going in the right direction. And yeah, but that wouldn't. You couldn't just say, well, that's it, that's job done. It would still have to be moving upwards and ultimately looking to, as things are structured at the moment, to link in with the manufacturer once more and go forward from there.
Mark, I have a question here. I know this is a subject close to your heart, and this is a question from someone called F1 Engineer. Why are the tyres so bad? Are Pirelli capable of providing a better tyre for F1, or are they limited by the technology of the construction of the tyres?
Yeah, it's my understanding is that it's to do with the manufacturing process that Pirelli employs for these tyres, which is the it's very automated, and it's it has to be a relatively cheap way to produce them because of the deal that the commercial side of the deal, it costs a lot of money to do. To be the tyre supplier for Formula One. So they have they're extruded. They're not sort of hand-built like a traditional racing tyre. And the chemicals needed to make it runny enough to be extruded are the chemicals that are the limiting factors in the tyre's behaviour. So there's sort of widespread misunderstanding between on the one hand, a tyre that can be raced hard, which will still see a reduction in performance as it wears, like a traditional tyre that we used to have from Bridgestone and Michelin, as opposed to a tyre that has to be kept at a certain temperature to stay in its performance window, which imposes a slow pace, but a long stint, which is what we have now. So you can go softer on compound, but which makes the tyre faster at its peak, but you still have to keep it in that temperature threshold, so you have to drive it even slower. So you get caught in this, you get trapped in these one-stop races in which the drivers aren't flat out. So they corrected this a couple of years ago, but it's crept back in because as the faster the cars have got, and particularly when they went to the wider body cars last year, the easier this threshold is reached. So it's a really intractable problem unless, you can give us a completely different, more traditional type of tyre, and that might require a very, very different commercial model in order to allow them to afford to do that, if indeed they can.
Was anyone other than Pirelli seriously in the frame, do you think, for the
No,
for the
Pirelli's
contract?
Been confirmed. It's there until 2023.
Yeah. Well, from the minutiae of tyres, maybe we could pull back and just talk pretty generally, I suppose, about Liberty and what we think about the relatively new owners. This was the season when I think a lot of people were hoping that some of the changes that Liberty had talked about were going to kind of come to fruition or at least be visible. I mean, my sense is that it's been slightly underwhelming. Simon, what do you think? Has there been a significant change? I mean, will they need to do better? I mean, where are we with Liberty at the moment?
I applaud Liberty's apparent will to change things. The problem I have is that 90% of the time when they issue a press release, I don't understand what they're telling me they're trying to change. It's all written in sort of corporate gobbledygook, and it's strenuous. I'd like to think that I've got a reasonable grasp of the English language, but that doesn't look like the English language. So I mean, I think obviously they've got a lot of experience with sports media, sports operations, but Formula One operates in a very, very different way to pretty much any other sporting model. And I think it just they need time to. I get the sense that because of the way that Bernie had set things up, with so many interlinked little wheels and deals here, there, and everywhere. It's a bit like trying to, the problem the government presently has trying to work out how to do a Brexit. It's a very, very complex, it's a very incredibly complex structure. And I think they've probably been slightly surprised by the scale of that structure.
I was going to say Brexit, the mention of Brexit will date this podcast, but I suspect it will, even if you're listening to it in 2 years' time.
So will the 2018 season review title. Well,
fair point.
But yeah, I mean, I think we'd all like to see some of the stuff that seemed so obvious in the Bernie era, like making having some kind of digital presence, which he just didn't. I mean, it was non-existent in Bernie's era. Formula One, they had a website, but it had very little digital presence. You've got all this fantastic action that you can do things with, and because the TV footage cost about a zillion pounds for 10 seconds or whatever, if you wanted to use it on anything outside the Formula One broadcasts, whatever the rate was, you know, it didn't appear anywhere. And there are all these things that could be done, and I hope in time will be done, to bring it to a bigger audience. But I mean, we've had talk of a race in Miami, hasn't happened. There's a new one coming up in Hanoi, Vietnam's not a country with great motor racing heritage, but it's an interesting project. I'm looking forward to seeing quite where Liberty plans to take the sport, but I don't think it needs 25 races a year.
I mean, my feeling is, I suppose, and I'd be interested to hear what you think, Mark, is that Liberty has kind of got itself caught in a bit of a tricky position, where it seems to have upset pretty much every, from circuits to the major teams, to the commercial rights holders for TV. It's kind of, at one point or another throughout the season, it's managed to aggravate all of those sort of stakeholders, if you like, and it can sometimes gives the impression of being slightly isolated.
Yeah, I think it's acquired the sport at a time of real structural change in terms of television audiences and how many people actually will in future be interested in watching cars go around a track. I think looking to the past to try and get clues, but the clues can't really come from the past. It's a less rapacious owner than CVC was, and it's more open-minded and it's better at marketing. But I don't think it is fundamentally visionary in outlook. I think it is fundamentally just trying to steady the ship and keep the money coming in. And as the model is changing very, very rapidly, so they're looking to see how they can move to a different area to keep the income coming in. But I think it should be accepted that long term, commercially, the sport will be inevitably smaller than it is, or smaller than it's been at its peak. And I think everything needs to be scaled down, and that's the biggest challenge that Liberty has. How you scale down something that has been based upon old technology, old boom time economics, the old model, which none of which no longer applies. And sort of Bernie got out just as that was sort of evolving away from his ability to control.
Fascinating. It's going to be interesting, isn't it, to see how it develops and as you say, how it evolves. But I mean, I'm pretty sure that Liberty didn't buy it as a diminishing sport, as you say. But listen, we are sort of running up against our deadline. I just wanted to mention a couple of other things. One thing that hasn't been mentioned, and maybe Rob, I could throw this one to you, and maybe the fact that it hasn't been mentioned says it all, but Halo. I mean, remember at the beginning of the season, all the column inches written about it, the words spoken about it, the passionate arguments for and against it, and to my mind, it hasn't been an issue other than in potentially saving Charles Leclerc's life.
I think it was one of those things that when the covers were pulled off of all the cars in January, everyone went, what the hell is that? It stands out appallingly. It might as well be covered in pink glitter. But then as soon as they went out to practice at Melbourne, it was Formula One and what Halo. The Leclerc thing showed that it's good. I think almost indisputably. I was a little bit sceptical as to whether it actually did its job, but then you can go into micro minutiae about, okay, would the wheel have hit the natural roll hoop, or would it have done this? It's been shown that it did avoid a visor strike fairly recently. That's got to be a good thing. I've got to say, it worried me at Abu Dhabi, seeing Hülkenberg upside down, saying amusingly he was hanging there like a pig, and then reporting fire. And you think, well, thankfully marshals were there and it was great. But we've yet to actually see any kind of real inversion, fortunately, I will say. But I mean, what happens if a car goes over into gravel somewhere like Catalunya at the back of the circuit? How does the driver get out? So I don't think it's a final design. In terms of aesthetics, actually, I think Formula E has done quite a good job of making a car with the halo being particularly less noticeable in the design. But then presumably they've seen what Formula One's done and had a blank sheet of paper to design a car anyway, so they've had the choice. It's not just been plonked on top of a Grand Prix car. I think it's always going to look better. There will be the purists out there that say it's not needed, but it has been. Anything that helps safety is a great thing, even if it looks a bit naff.
And finally, to sort of round off this season review, we've got a question here from, and I'm going to try and get this name right, Abdella Al Qastani, or Wistani. I offer this somewhat light-hearted question to the experts. But maybe you could answer. From Lewis, Sebastian, Alonso, Kimi, Max and Ricciardo, which is the one quality you would take from each of these drivers?
He missed out Tatsuya Nuvolari.
I'm not going to ask you all individually, but maybe together we could pool our heads and pool our thoughts and just come up with a list of things that we really like about each of those drivers, what their strengths are, what their defining strength.
Ricciardo's racecraft.
I would like Kimi's liver. I think we can all aspire to that.
Not sure you'd want his liver after the awards.
I think Hamilton's relentless dedication is his biggest mm-hmm. quality. His intense focus.
Fantastic. Mark, listen. Final word from you as our Grand Prix editor. How do you rate the 2018 season? I mean, obviously, you've covered more than most people have had hot dinners. How do you rate it?
Pretty good, but room for improvement. And if we could see Ferrari achieving its full potential next year and Honda delivering for Red Bull, then we might have a vintage season.
Fantastic. Rob?
Mark, just out of interest, who's your money on for next year?
Yeah, I say Vettel every time and I always get it wrong. So.
See, I said that and you've now doomed me.
I say Vettel, but just, you know, in hope of change. Not because I've got anything against Mercedes or Hamilton, just because we need a shake-up of the order.
And on that note, I think we all have to call an end to this 2018 season review. Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you, Simon. Thank you, Rob. And thank you all for listening. There are more podcasts on the Motorsport Magazine website, which you can download. And we wish you a very happy Christmas and a very merry new year. And we'll see you back in the paddock in 2019. But for now, from all of us, goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.